Ringer Films and HBO's Jagged is the next installment of the Music Box series, taking you to 1995 when a 21-year-old Alanis Morissette burst onto the music scene. With never-before-seen archival material and an in-depth interview with Alanis herself, Jagged explores her beginnings as a young Canadian pop star, the rocky path she faced navigating the male-dominated music industry, and the glass ceiling she shattered on her journey to becoming the international icon and empowered artist she is today. Watch or stream Jagged on HBO or HBO Max this Thursday, November 18th.
This episode is brought to you by Jiffy Lube. Cars can be a big investment, so it's important to take care of them. I once got a car that I started out with 25,000 miles on. I got it to over 200,000 miles because I took care of it. You know how you take care of a car? You take care of the maintenance, the oil, the brakes, all that stuff. And if you don't, you can have a car just completely fall apart. When your car needs maintenance, head to Jiffy Lube. They provide automotive excellence at speed. Get your oil changed, brakes checked, tons of other multi-care services. It's all done by expertly trained technicians who actually care about taking care of you and your car. Jiffy Lube, car more. To find coupons and start an instant online estimate, visit JiffyLube.com.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, imploring you to read Plato. Read Plato. It's Andy Greenwald.
No, there were so many ones about like joining up, double acts, fuckety fucks. I was surprised you went with Plato, but that's good because you think of me as booker.
It's the Spettenberger Pod.
What's up?
What's up, captain of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers? We ready to go? We ready
Thank
to do
you.
This?
Yes, the spread offense.
It's the Succession podcast. It's episode 6, What It Takes, where Logan Roy goes to market to pick a president. And Andy and I are going to break down the episode. We can start with some general feelings trending up or down. Andy, where do you want to start?
Well,
we usually do the state of Succession before we get into the nitty gritty, right?
Right. I think that, and I don't know, you know, we didn't pregame. So no. I don't know where you are with this. We're recording this on Thursday. We don't know where, the pulse of America is at. It's not like we work for ATN, but I feel strongly at this moment that when the history of the show is written, this episode is going to be mentioned. I think this is an extremely important, consequential, and masterful episode of Succession.
I thought it was very, very, very important. And yeah. It reminded me of other times on this show, and we've discussed kind of at an arm's length over the years when we've been discussing Succession, is the relationship between the audience and the characters. And, you know, the traditional television relationship, I think maybe, say, best exemplified by something like Friday Night Lights, where you start to almost project yourself into the world that you want to be in, have, you know, Eric Taylor, Tammy Taylor be your dad and mom, have these people be your brothers and sisters, have these people be your friends, have this town be the town you live in, stuff like that. That may not apply to everybody, but you get where I'm going. There's that version of TV. And then there's the version of TV that is Succession, where because of time spent, I think you kind of tend to start to sympathize with, empathize with, identify with, but just like your sheer amount of time you spend with characters develops a familiarity and maybe even an affection. And then Edgelord Roman comes out. You know what I mean? And every once in a while, this show reminds you who you're watching. And I think that that's pretty important. So I was curious whether or not you saw things that way here.
I know what you're speaking about, and I loved it and I found it bracing. And I think that my main, you know, I can't wait to talk about some of the just story mechanics at work here, what this episode does for the season, what it does for the trajectory of the show at large, and specifically the diving in feet first into the world of politics the way the episode did. But I think because you brought up the Roman thing, and we've spent a couple of weeks being like, well, Roman's humanity of all of these Roys is the most tangible.
You know, on the surface.
It is the most on the surface. And then, yeah, he does a full performance art red pill piece.
Pivots to H. Yeah.
He pivots to the hard H.
Yeah.
That could be potentially off-putting, et cetera, et cetera. But I think rather than finding it off-putting, I found it even more compelling because it is just the other side of his, you know, impossible, irrepressible sadness and pathos. Mm-hmm. They are deeply connected in this character, and I think the show is doing a fantastic job of portraying that. What I found to be the sort of compelling backbeat to that turn was Tom. And, you know, before we get into it, maybe I'll just give you a teaser because I know we like to do a little bit of like, here's what happened in this episode. You know,
sure.
I just to run it down. But I think that, you know, last week I strapped on my waders and I went under the bridge and I had a little conversation, not Red Hot Chili Pepper style, more like Aesop. Had a chat with a concern troll, right? And yeah. I think the thing that I want to say is about where Succession is going and what it means, et cetera, et cetera. I'd like to say here officially on this podcast something that everybody who listens already knows, which is Jesse Armstrong is smarter than us and is very much in control of the show and has an enchanted shield that reflects the concern troll's powers back to him, thus negating him.
Is that a Zelda thing?
The reason I was thinking it might be.
Yeah.
I'm fishing for something like that. But the reason I say that is up to now, I think I, along with a lot of the audience, was looking at the cast of characters, the pantheon of Succession characters, and thinking, this is interesting because we have all of these Roys who are all aliens, essentially, and buffoons in equal measure. And then we have Greg, who is more or less a buffoon. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us were watching Greg being like, well, when is he going to flip? When is he going to turn? He's, you know, if you were going to absolutely just, 200,000 foot it from the pilot. Oh, he's our point of view character because he's new to this family. And so he's sort of on the outs. And that's actually been a misdirection. Does he speak up for the, you know, the moral heart of America, or at least of people in America who liked Hamilton, but really liked Hamilton when he says that Conor Roy should not be anointed president? Yes. But during all this time, one thing that I definitely took my eye off of, and I feel like the audience maybe did as well, is that not everyone in the inner circle was born to it. And the person who really wasn't born to it is Tom, who, from everything we know, is just kind of a nice guy from Minnesota.
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was Wisconsin, but yeah, like just a Midwest farm boy. Yeah, right.
Flyover guys like us, what's the diff, right? Apologies to everyone in the heartland of America for that. But Tom isn't born to this. Tom doesn't fit into this. And Tom, all of a sudden, becomes the linchpin to, I think, unlocking not only the season, but to understanding the perspective that the audience has to maintain vis-a-vis the Roys. And I just thought that was so expertly and brilliantly done. And it helps that you have Matthew McFadden, who is one of the best actors of his generation, probably,
sure,
in that role. So triumphant episode top to bottom, withering, brilliant, funny, insightful, incredibly, uncomfortably, neck-itchingly zeitgeisty. But more than anything else, like a deeply human episode, I think, mostly because of Matthew McFadden and what Jesse Armstrong and his writers are doing with Tom.
Yeah, so the zeitgeist thing was my only crumbs for the troll that I had this week. And it really isn't a concern troll thing as much as it is an observation, which is essentially, did you find the horse trading, almost literally, that going on in the hotel suite to be not unlike Kendall's engagement with Twitter earlier in the season, where that was kind of liberal Twitter's like sleep paralysis demon coming to life and being like, this is, you know, this idea of all these Maggie Haberman articles that you've been reading about people meeting in a room and making these awful decisions about the fate of the country. Did that sort of feel almost so on the nose that it felt untrue in a Wire season 5? Wait, you guys thought this is how newspapers worked? Kind of way?
I totally appreciate that. Wire season 5, though, was very accurate about how serial killers work.
Sure.
Right? And the investigation of them. So let's never forget that. I'm glad you asked that question. Happy to once again lift my kind of made-up Zelda shield and say no.
Yeah, I just thought I would throw it out there for the sake of conversation.
No, I think it's worth asking. And I think no for two reasons. Reason number one was that, you know, one, this has been something the show has been criticized for and lauded for, which is portraying the ultra, ultra, ultra rich as completely siloed from reality. Mm-hmm. This goes all the way back to the, you know, the New Yorker profile where Jesse Armstrong is like, we're not going to do COVID because it didn't matter to them anyway. To the ultra rich, it didn't affect them. And the show has done a very good job of that. And it was interesting looking back in hindsight after this episode to sort of interrogate my own interactions with those scenes. And really, they've been pretty benign and passive. Like, well, of course there are yachts where you can't wear shoes or else you'll mess up the teak. Like, and that's where they're spending all their time. Sure. Like, I understand that objectively, that there is a tier beyond the tier that people are spending every day in. And that's just, you know, that's just part of what you buy the ticket for when you enter the capitalism rodeo. Sure. What was different about this and the way it was portrayed was that it was this, honestly, for me, chill-inducing reminder that these people, these characters and their analogs in the real world are fiddling away on their yachts and in their mega skyscrapers. Well, literally, we burn. Mm-hmm. It is not, we're sort of inured to it in the fictional sense, but oh no, this is actually our lives and our futures and our children's futures being, thrown against the wall like dice in some back alley. Like that is actually what this is. And I found that really brilliantly done. The flip side of it is, and I want to get your thoughts on this too, of course, because you're the one that has been saying this, or at least has suggested this, which are the many similarities between Succession and Veep. Not just that they're both on HBO, and there's definitely some shared DNA from mm-hmm. British comedy writer Hive, right? And also just the sort of savagery with which British writers of a certain age
and class
can...
Yeah, the Armstrong, Iannucci school. Yeah, right.
What they have to say about America, et cetera, et cetera. What I thought was just incredible about this was, the jokes in this episode, the burns, the observations, I mean, as good as any, and as certainly as funny as anything on a comedy written by Iannucci or anyone else from that school. But the thing about Veep is that it was essentially an absurdist comedy being like, all of this is worth nothing. This is all just, it's nothing. You know, it's all just curses and sweat and backstabbing for a poison chalice. And mm-hmm. that's kind of funny. The difference between the comedy and the drama is that the stakes in this just felt really, really, really deeply felt and uncomfortable. And it was played off of Shiv's face. And I thought that Sarah Snook did a great job in the episode where you feel how slippery the slope is from helping your family to hobnobbing and bullshitting at a cocktail party to having to smile in a photograph next to an actual fascist.
Yeah.
And it was powerful.
Her hubris getting deflated at the end where she, even in the final moments, is like, well, my vote counts for more because I understand this scenario. And she just gets outplayed by Roman essentially in that moment.
And how about the ultimate, I mean, she makes a big deal this episode about how, you know, Dad, you humiliated me mm-hmm. in the previous episode. I'm not sure there's any humiliation deeper than agreeing to be photographed next to a fascist, but one person removed from the fascist and her father just saying, you win, Pinky.
Yeah, right.
What did she win? I'm sorry.
Right.
What did she win? It was weirdly devastating this episode to me in a way that I think emotionally Succession doesn't always reach. I felt in previous episodes empathy for the characters, which is a testament to the writing and certainly the performances. But this is the one that kind of reached in and kind of jiggled me up a little bit.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you should say that because this is an episode largely absent of Kendall, in so much as he did not participate in the central family mm-hmm. drama of the week. You know, he is on the periphery. He has his Department of Justice meeting. He fires his lawyer, gives a couple of like buzzword speeches, and then has that incredible scene with Tom. But for the most part,
Hall of Fame scene
is like FaceTiming into this episode for a lot of it. It's really, I think, I wonder whether or not the reason why it shook you was because it got dumped on the different kids this time. You know, the sort of reversal of fortune hit Shiv harder because Kendall wasn't there to take a couple of the bullets.
I think it was partly that. I think Kendall, I mean, look, that note is something the show hits really well. And I want to spend some time talking about that Tom and Kendall scene so we can circle back to it because I think it's, you know, that goes on the highlight reel for the series.
Yeah.
But
I have some notes.
the blow that Tom lands on Kendall, you know, mm-hmm. it's incredible how many variations on the "you have detonated my heart" face Jeremy Strong has. Like, you'd think that maybe he would have used them all in the first two seasons, but yeah. No, that's still going. I don't think it was so much that. I do think that there was, it's one thing to watch the gods mess around on Mount Olympus, right? Like, if you're reading mythology or something, they're always like, oh, they're playing tricks on each other and they're always stealing each other's best cattle for sacrifice, whatever. I read a lot of Greek myths with my children. Sorry. It hits different when the capricious gods come down from the mountain, fuck everything up, mm-hmm. and then climb back up the mountain, you know, and that feeling, there was something very intense for me about the contempt as it got closer to the surface of the earth where we live, even though obviously it's a fictional show, you know, but it was a really fascinating, maybe this is the first time I've correctly used the term heat check. But for someone like Roman, where we're like, oh, we like Roman. How great. And then you realize that, you know, he would harvest us all for our livers if his father needed a liver. Like, it's not a thing for him.
So really, I mean, we've pretty much synopsized this episode without even trying, but it basically revolves around the picking of the next president after the Raisin has announced that he's not going to run again. And by the end of the episode, Edgelord Roman Roy kind of emerges and convinces his father to back a character named Jared Mankin, who's played by Justin Kirk. And I have a lot to say about this performance.
Me too.
He plays him as this kind of Peter Thiel, Jared Kushner, Trump hybrid.
Matt Gaetz kind
of. Yeah, like populism with a 4chan sense of humor, creeping racism, nationalism. And he gets picked for his box office potential more than anything else over like a Pencian VP and a centrist Republican played by Yul Vasquez, who's an actor I like a lot. And, you know, he's telegenic and he's willing to say the quiet racist part loud. And it doesn't hurt that Roman wants to fuck him.
I think that's part of it.
Yeah. Like, I mean, whether or not that is explicit in the script, it's definitely explicit in the way that Kirk and Kieran Culkin decided to play the scenes that they had together. And
that
they
scene
had
in the bathroom,
more sexual chemistry than almost any other pairing.
It was incredible. Also, yeah. I want to know who gave Kieran Culkin the direction, or was it just actor generated? Where he's like, when I begin this conversation, I'm just going to be moisturizing my hands furiously.
Yeah. While Justin Kirk's like, I push boundaries.
it's pretty sexy stuff. I mean, I think, again, if you take a step back, one of the best things about the show is a slightly outsider sensibility and perspective on the American political culture. And I don't say that because there aren't Americans who see the game for what it is. But I think it's worth remembering that the Murdoch family, who are obviously in deep inspiration, I mean, to us personally with our podcast,
Burgeoning
Empire, but certainly for the show, are Australian and came here and saw the vulnerabilities of this country and ripped them to shreds and took full advantage of them. There's a certain canniness that is at the root of the satire that makes it land. And or not just the satire, just the depiction. And what I mean here is the understanding that the Logan Roy, Rupert Murdochs of the world don't exist in an arena where morality matters or politics matter. They are newspaper men, they're media men, they are spectacle, they're P.T. Barnums. And the reason Logan stays alive is because he's not hiding behind hashtag trending topics like Kendall is to try to build a tiny, tiny sputtering campfire of relevance. He understands that the show will go on regardless mm-hmm. of whether he's the star of it or not. And the way you keep the show going is you get fucking bigger elephants, or elephants that will literally kill people, or at least round them into camps. You know, there is no hesitation on his part to make what is obviously the better play for the future of his television channel. And that's all that it's all that matters. That's all that it comes down to. And I love how relatively uncomplicated that decision was for Logan Roy. It was so well played by Brian Cox, who has pendulum has swung all the way back in the saddle.
Yeah, he's doing great.
Absolutely.
The UTI
apex
is
predator.
All cleared up. Yeah.
All that ocean spray he downed between the episodes, just cleaned it all out, cleaned out the scepter. Yeah, I mean, that's what makes sense. And Roman's relentless hounding of Shiv for her, you know, her failures as a political operative, yeah, it's all static and chatter like it always is between them, but he does draw blood because essentially I think what he is identifying is that she did that because she thought it mattered. Mm-hmm. He uses that mocking voice, but that is true. I think she kind of on some level was like, I'm going to be important.
I absolutely 100% think that Shiv thinks she's walking into that meeting being like, I am the expert in the room. I'm the smartest person in the room and they're going to defer to my knowledge here. And yes, if I can get away with it, I might just push us blue here, you know, and there would be a moment where, and there she says, she's like, I think we should go Dems. And it winds up slingshotting all the way back around. So it's not blue. It's the reddest of reds. You know, she thinks that she can go Salgado or getting him to back up Democrat. And it winds up being, oh no, we're going to go for this maniac.
It's incredible. She walks into this room with her father being like, you should listen to me because I once had a consulting gig for a clown. Mm-hmm. And he's like, clowns don't own the fucking circus. Right. You know what I mean? Clowns work for the circus. And you can always find more clowns. That is baked into the episode. It's baked into the show's understanding of American politics at this moment, which I find, you know, disturbingly accurate. And it's the little touches in the episode, you know, like calling the vice president Dave.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, the characterizations are so perfect. Sometimes when you're watching in the moment, the show can feel like this batting practice of jokes coming at you. And it's just like this perfect pitch after perfect pitch, mm-hmm. after perfect pitch. Then you kind of think back and it's like, they essentially, you can tell by the stunt casting sort of, you can tell that like it's Justin Kirk is the important person to keep your eye on at the beginning of the episode. But even the way that they describe the vice president as having wet lips or going vegetarian and waiting so there for 10 minutes, all of those things accumulate. You're like, this guy's going to lose. And then when they do that scene in the dinner, the sort of dining area, and like that's where the Plato part happens with Mencken. I keep calling him Mencken, like H.L. Mencken. I don't know why. What is it, Mencken?
I think it's Mencken.
Yeah,
but there has to be some intentionality there. That is not exactly that doesn't trip lightly off the tongue.
Sure. In any case, I just found that the way the economy with which the show kind of characterizes bit players and then moves on very quickly, this felt like it had a lot more momentum. I realized how ready I was for the shareholder meeting and the corporate takeover part of the show to be like, great, in the rearview mirror.
Since you mentioned Justin Kirk, let's just briefly talk about the embarrassment of riches here at
this
table.
Ridiculous.
Because the thing that Succession has conquered is that it exists in the perfect Venn diagram center of something that, you know, the first piece I ever wrote for Grandland, the HBO recycling project, where mm-hmm. like all their great actors appear in all of their shows. So they've got that going for them. And then on top of that, so that's why you get, you know, Stephen Root is just on this show now. And right.
Hope Davis for four scenes, you know.
And this other thing that we were talking about, and maybe we were overly crediting Frank Rich for this, maybe it's not just him, but I couldn't help but wonder, like this direct pipeline to the New York theater royalty.
Yeah.
And so stepping in as Vice President Dave is Reed Birney, recent Tony winner, who's just a genius in everything he does and knows exactly how to be an entirely fully realized person, even if he's never on the show again. You know, that is something that you cannot teach, and it is something you definitely can't just walk out to Hollywood and buy. Mm-hmm. And then you go down the line of those people in that room. Yes, Stephen Root is there sort of conducting. You have Reed Birney. You have Yul Vasquez, Silver Fox Yul Vasquez, by the way, not with the dyed job he had in Russian Doll. Another great New York theater actor who's having a moment. He was in Russian Doll. He's going to be in the upcoming Apple show Severance. Phenomenal actor and brings a gravity to just those few scenes. You get it. You understand why Shiv's fighting for him. You would love to see more of him, or maybe we'll never see him again.
Right.
And then Justin Kirk, who I want to clear out and let you talk about this. I really like him as a performer, but I also find him fascinating because he's so versatile. He can do comedy, he can do drama, but I feel like very often people don't know what to do with him.
Yeah.
Like he works constantly. And when I was casting Briar Patch, for example, casting director talk about him reverentially. They worship him for his, you know, apparently a good guy, but also just so talented. But they're always like, well, how can we fit him into this box? Because he doesn't always fit.
And yeah, then, he's got leading man looks. Right. He's got leading man looks, and he's got maybe a lizard's heart. You know, when you actually like watch the way he has such a facility with, I mean, honestly, chillingly a facility with moving through that, the language and the vocabulary of sort of this neo-fascist, it's irony, but it's not. And I'm borrowing from Franco, but also from Thomas Aquinas. And he's just like turret gunning through this stuff. Yet he has a kind of, I don't know, a sweetness to him. Like if you, I mean, it's, it was kind of speaking of the HBO, you know, being in the HBO Pro League, it's kind of wild to watch the guy from Angels in America do this, you know, and it speaks to his range, even though there is a character's actor. Like if you cast Justin Kirk, you're going to get this specific kind of like wiseacre, but you know, he is the New York wise ass, you know, that Logan was referring to a little while ago. It was like, he has that kind of New York theater, intellectual heft to the way he does, no matter what the genre he's working in.
You know, one thing that is a constant with the great British actors is that they are just, and it always, it never ceases to dazzle. They just seem so competent with both comedy and drama. And Stephen Root is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. Someone who people couldn't quite figure out why he was so great or what to do with him for a bunch of years because, well, he was the funniest thing on news radio, but he's also a brilliant actor. And then you see him on Boardwalk Empire and you see him being able to do both on Barry. So of course he fits in here. Of course he can. It's not a thing for him. It's what he does. Justin Kirk, Angels in America, but also Animal Practice, the short-lived NBC sitcom where he had to share screen with a monkey. Mm-hmm. This is the kind of facility that you want when you're giving voice to a show that also moves so deftly between those worlds. And also it's, the other thing about him, he's capturing that kind of like that, you know, dark TikTok parlor energy, but with a sort of puckish glint in his eye, but he's 52. So he has the heft. You know what I mean? It's a great casting. It's a great character.
He plays the DA on Perry Mason on the HBO, the reboot with Perry Mason with Matthew Reese. In that show, on this show, it's interesting because you can visualize him as Kendall. You could see him as Kendall. You could see him as the Perry Mason character on Perry Mason. Like you could see him doing these lead roles. And there's almost like an energy to his supporting work that has lead actor charisma, but is reduced playing time. And I would love to see him carry his own show. I mean, I know he's done it before, but.
What do you think about, while we're talking about the contenders in this in this gross room, where this gross room of men who lift Greg on their shoulders like he's the Stanley Cup, the other would-be elephant in the room full of GOP elephants is Connor.
Yeah.
And I mean, God, what must it be like to write and make a show where like your last line of defense is always Alan Ruck? You know what I mean? Where it's just like, not that they're ever in doubt of what to do with the scene, but they could always just be like, let's just toss it to Connor for a line.
Sure.
Or for that Stephen Root scene with him and Justine Lupe. So good. The moment when it's plausible, just briefly in the hotel suite.
Where they're entertaining
where it's plausible.
It. Plausible. Yeah.
How great was that moment? Because I, as a, you know, maybe the most skeptical audience member that's my tier of audience where I'm the most skeptical of almost anything any show does, even the things that I love, even the ones that I love. I was like, yeah, I could see them doing this. I could see them just making this turn and pulling it off. Did you believe that there was any, for a moment, that they were going to do this?
There was a second, because I do find that while I adore Alan Ruck as a performer and I adore Connor as a character, he is the third leg a little bit here. You know what I mean? Like everybody has a purpose on this show right now. And Connor's purpose is to come in and say, oh, we had to fly. What was it? Scheduled. Is that what it was? What he said?
Instead commercial? Of a PJ. Yeah.
And he and Willa just kind of being, the last two people on the guest list for every party that they're going to with the Roy's.
Willa playwriting in the notes app.
Yeah. What does he call her? My Mary Todd. What does he say? There was a moment where I was like, are they really going to do this? But I was thrilled and terrified to see where they took it. And I think that one of the highlights of the season so far for me was definitely that bathroom scene that we referred to between Roman and Jared, where, like you mentioned, the choice that Culkin makes to be moisturizing his hands while the two of them dressed identically with identical haircuts just kind of make fuck eyes at one another while talking about fascism.
I mean, isn't it interesting that the show is nudging this idea forward, which is Kendall and Siobhan, who are obviously like the clubhouse leaders for people who are handicapping the show,
sure,
like it's some sort of sporting event.
Not that we would ever do that. Yeah.
Never. Not us. Are being exposed week after week, not just as ill-informed or ill-suited to the time, but really fighting the wrong wars, like fighting yesterday's wars. And there's something that is emerging. I mean, it's always been there, but at least it's emerging into my consciousness and I think to the main stage of the show, that Roman really is this, is made for this particular moment. There's such a dark and toxic stew of just absolute naked emotional hurt, longing, and neediness that is subsumed into this collection of like holy, smarter than thou, clever, nothing fucking matters, nihilistic hand ticks. You know, it's,
yes,
he is Twitter, right? He is social media made flesh in a way.
But
so of course he can navigate this.
He's
moment.
Doing the same thing Kendall's doing. He's just using the complete opposite terms. Kendall's doing, you know, resistance Twitter, Me Too.
Right.
You know, like as Stewie says, standing on a rainbow box and screaming time's up, and fucking Roman's like moving the Overton window and mocking everything Shiv says in a like, oh, you actually care. All you're doing is doing route one. But in that bathroom, Roman actually pitches a plausible version of a way, yes, forward for that company in a way that Kendall can't, because Kendall's just like buying Valter and, you know, rolling up like different verticals. Roman knows what he's got and he knows where it should go.
Exactly. We are David Simon making season 5 of The Wire, able to talk about the mistakes made in media v. new media over the last decade, right? And fundamentally, where a lot of shit went wrong was old media was always going to be old media. And new media was like, we could try some new stuff, but maybe we still want to do fact checking and we'll kind of be like the old ways of doing it. And then old media bought new media and was like, well, just be like more like us. And it all collapsed. And then, right, there were a couple people who were like, no, it's just going to be teens dancing for 10 seconds. And also a little sprinkling of fascism. Like, that's, right, actually what this is. So stop fucking pretending that you're going to win a Pulitzer. You know what I mean? And, right, Roman is that. Roman does not have the, he shouldn't necessarily be lauded for his complete lack of sensitivity or morals, but he certainly is meeting the moment in, yeah, a way that suits both the company and, more directly, his father, who is the oldest person. Well, is he the oldest person on the show? He's certainly the oldest person. He's the eminence grease of the Roy family. But because he is just, as you know, we said before, he's an apex predator. And that type of predation doesn't go out of style.
What did you think of the Carrie development of him having a rumored affair with his assistant?
It was very interesting. It was very Succession, where subplots can sometimes just emerge fully formed from the back room. Like, there wasn't a lot of hand-holding with this, because this was not...
No.
This wasn't Jess, or what's her name? Dagmara Domenichik's character.
Carolina.
I'm blanking it. Carolina. Like, it's not someone who's been there the whole time. This is someone who, as far as I know, and I may not be the most careful watcher of the show, but I don't remember seeing her.
I believe she is a recent addition. I think she is a this season addition, but I can't guarantee that. But yeah.
So I kind of like it when things hide in plain sight, and it plays into something we talked about a couple of weeks ago, which is that the rhythm the show seems to work best in is one in which Logan is generally opaque.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when he closes the doors, we don't know about, because it's better when we're all like with the kids themselves scrabbling for crumbs to drop from the throne. What it means for the show, I couldn't tell you. I mean, it's always a weird, like, it was a weird swing when she had something to say to the sitting vice president.
Yeah, you know? I think everybody in the room felt that way. You know, when he points at her, right, when she gives him the eyes, when Roman's making his pitch for Jared. I imagine we'll see more of Jared as the season goes on, and I'm very interested in seeing ATN and the Roy family in action. You know, now that they are kind of back doing what they did to build this empire, which is sort of maneuvering and manipulating the American political system and the temperature of the country, yeah, to sell fucking bedpans.
I mean, the show the ATN of it has kind of been on the slow boil.
Yeah, with the exception of Ravenwood, we have not done a lot of like what are the mechanics of ATN?
And also, how important is it to the Empire? And I thought this episode did a pretty, not just brilliant, but efficient job of communicating it. I mean, Roman said that the audience, much like its real world analog Fox News, the audience is primarily the coveted demographic known as almost deads. Mm-hmm. But it remains like the most powerful or most immediate lever to exact institutional power in this country. And so the fact that everyone has now returned to that as the centerpiece, as the government is, you know, although unclear where the case stands, while the government is gunning for them, they can gun right back and potentially blow the government out of the water. It's an interesting place to go. It's also the kind of place that I don't think the show, I think the show was smart not to begin here. You know, mm-hmm. there's no version of this show with Adam McKay involved and from the beginning that wasn't going to do this.
Sure.
I think this is what motivated him to want to make a show like this, but even before Jesse Armstrong got involved and created it and shaped it. It feels appropriate to end up here now that we trust them and we know what they're doing and we've established the other things that the family does or has its paws in.
Yeah, I mean, I am happiest when I feel like the show is deviating furthest from its original proposition. You know, this idea of which one of these kids is going to succeed Logan, we will eventually answer that question. There's so much fun shit we could get into on the way there. Having a kind of repeating cycle of Kendall trying and failing to usurp his father. I don't know what Jeremy Strong does if he's not doing that. I'm very curious to find out. He is obviously, I think, one of the two or three best actors on television right now, if not the best. So I want him to be busy on this show. But it was interesting to see him marginalized. I often the show is compared to Billions, or Billions is compared to Succession. Billions, despite the billion subplots it had, you know, for the most part over the six seasons it's been on, or seven seasons it's been on, has been pretty much obsessed with this Axe versus Chuck, like who will get who thing, you know, and ultimately Damian Lewis left the show, as people know from reading the news, even if you're not reading the show, watching the show, Damian Lewis is leaving the show. And I think that solved its problem for it. I don't know that Succession will ever experience an absence like that. But I really would love to see them knee deep in a presidential election. That seems really fucking entertaining. We should talk a little bit about the Kendall stuff, though.
Yeah.
Did you have one more point you wanted to make?
No, I wanted to pivot to the Kendall stuff. It's like you're reading my mind.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, is that it for Sana Lathan? Pretty big actress. Just we're gonna get two scenes.
Seems like it. I one thing that I think that we've learned. Well, let me say this: during the long national nightmare when Succession was not in our lives, we filled the vacuum as best we could, and one of the only ways that we could was by grabbing anything that fell from the royal plate. And spending weeks, days or weeks obsessing over it. I think one thing we've learned is that Succession has a very, very stacked pre-existing cast.
Mm-hmm.
It has a stacked cast of actors who are no longer in the main cast who could be called upon.
Sure.
When you need a Marsha or you need a Stewie. As you said already, Hope Davis is just, she's probably just hanging out on set. She's got COVID compliance. She's a veil. When we read Sanaa Lathan, Adrian Brody, the still as yet unseen Skarsgård, I think some of us were like either thinking they are joining the show as equals to the others, or we were like, oh, this is like Margot Martindale in the season of Justified. Like here come the big bads.
The big bads for the season, for sure.
Not the case.
No.
These were guest arcs.
Yeah, right. Like very traditional. You know,
And they are just people who get more headlines and probably get paid more than your Reed Bernies, your Stephen Roots, or your Mark Lynn Baker, by the way, speaking of New York theater guys, but
right.
will always be perfect strangers to people of a certain generation. I think that's where we're at. So maybe we just need to recalibrate our own thinking.
Yeah, like, I think I had the part. Same thing where I was like, where's the Peter Riegert episode? I don't think we're going to get it.
People just want to be on this show.
Yeah.
You know, if it wasn't such an excellent show and wonderfully written, and also a lot of actors, I don't know the particulars of these actors, but a lot of actors live in New York and are thrilled to be a part of a show where they don't have to travel. This is another place where, you know, the COVID question can come into it, where it's just like,
sure.
yeah, I'd love to work for 4 days. I haven't worked in 4 months. You know what right. I mean? So I'm available for this part. I think the other thing to think of is that if it's a good experience for everyone, they're in play now.
Right.
They're in play. You know, right. so
Lisa could come back as the lawyer for somebody else or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And Adrian Brody will be on the show again. But I think it seems pretty clear that he is not a major plot driver of the season. It certainly doesn't seem like it unless he's going to, you know, come roaring back with a takeover bit of his own. The Kendall stuff. It was interesting because maybe this speaks to your point about being eager to get the shareholder stuff off. Like I'm once they're done with the banter. I'm not as interested, and to its credit, I don't think the show is that interested in this either. I'm not particularly interested in the nitty-gritty of the government's case.
No, me neither.
And so tracking where it stands isn't the best place for the show to hang out in. So
Can I just do a little bit of like,
yeah.
be vulnerable here with you for a second?
Oh, always. You just had a big birthday.
Very, very close watcher of this show.
Mm-hmm.
So... are the documents in question in this episode the ones Greg gave him? Does he have them? Like, I'm a little unclear about some of that stuff.
My takeaway from this is that there are, and I'm sorry to complicate, muddy the waters further. When they say documents, there's two different document
right.
collections. One is the Greg Kendall documents.
Which were like the cruise the ship bombshell, murder docs, yeah.
Which, as... at least suggested by this episode, are not as damning as the press conference would have had you believe.
Mm-hmm.
The second piece, and maybe this is a comment on the first, is that when they agreed to cooperate, Waystar Royko unleashed the floodgates of documents and is basically drowning the government in paper. And some of it is maybe damning, some of it is maybe exculpatory, and some of it is just confusing. And that's what those lawyers are going through every minute to find something that suits their case, suits their interests. And it seems like, and this is sort of what I got from some of what Kendall was saying, they're just flooding the zone
mm-hmm.
and confusing everything
with
and slowing
discovery,
everything.
Yeah, and like
and slowing everything down. Yeah,
right. Okay, that's good to know.
I think the other takeaway, and I loved the scene where she's like, "Do you think you're smarter than me?" Like, mm-hmm. the show is what these moments when they are. These untouchable characters are touched when they are smacked in the snout like a badly behaving dog in an 80s movie before people understood how to treat dogs or would allow dogs to be treated like that way on the screen. Those are the powerful moments, right?
Uh-huh.
Where it's just like, oh, I'm going to have to start thinking of the toilet as my friend. Like this, there is another way of being here.
Yeah. You know, the other than that, I mean, the one thing I wanted to discuss regarding Kendall, and this gets back to Tom, is the diner scene, which I thought was...
Oh, wait, before we do diner, I just have to ask you one thing.
Yeah.
This is going to be underreported, because I thought it was going a different direction when he's like, we're going to fire Lisa, and he's just like, he's drinking bourbon or whatever it is, like it's Powerade. So I'm like, okay, so that's intentional. He's slipping a little bit in that way. But am I wrong? He was multitasking. He's also planning a 40th birthday party.
Yes, I believe that is the subject of the next episode.
Can't wait. This, yeah. In some ways, what does he call it? He says, ask his, are these people going to come to his antibiotic party?
Yeah, it's like AI meets like Bacchanal, like Roman Bacchanal.
Carthage? Yeah.
Carthage.
I guess if it's next week's episode, I'll save it because I did want to ask what similarities you felt between yourself, who recently celebrated a birthday, and Kendall in this episode, but we can circle back. Let's get to the diner.
Yeah. Two characters and two actors who can certainly do font size 26, you know, announcements with their performances. Like they can be big and they can fill up a screen, and then they're both playing it so, so quiet, appropriately for a clandestine meeting in a diner. But the moment where Tom does his ordering and Jeremy Strong's way of like taking that information in and then not even making eye contact with the waitress and saying, I'm just going to watch him.
Amazing.
It's so amazing. And then that scene just rolls from there. So like
I got to say, when I was talking before about how the show kind of blindsided me with the reminder that Tom is immortal, mm-hmm. Not immortal, he is a mortal person. Only Tom and Greg eat the diner food.
Right.
Kendall would fucking never, you know, right. In the same way that like, you know, again, from my daughter's Greek myths book, you know, when Persephone is stolen by Hades, mm-hmm. Lord of the Undead,
one
and
of my
the
favorites.
Underworld.
Yeah.
And her mother, Demeter, comes to rescue her. And Hades like, nah, she can't leave because she ate 6 pomegranate seeds. So she has to stay here for 6 months of the year. And that's why we have winter.
Uh-huh.
That was doused in Bisquick and maple syrup. Those were pomegranate seeds, man.
Did you like when Tom tells Greg, you have to eat that omelet like it's Afghanistan? You just take some territory and then move out?
I just feel like we are not worthy to have a show that has space for that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Speaking of which, I'm going to clear out for you about the wine in a minute, but... Yeah, the Tom Greg scene was just incredible, and the moment where Tom and Kendall scene was just incredible.
Both diner scenes were great, but yes, yeah. The Kendall scene was.
And the moment where Kendall thinks he's got another gotcha moment, where he's taking pictures of Tom meeting him so that he could blackmail him with it, and he's just like, "Who are you blackmailing? You know, mm-hmm. Do you think you played your card?" These guys skated and now they're picking the next president. So you think you're intimidating me by having a gotcha moment on your iPhone? Like you have nothing. And, you know, we've seen Kendall over the course of the season lose allies left and right increasingly, you know, no Lisa now. Sort of had his family members on side for half of an episode, now gone. Rava gone. Haven't seen Naomi in a while. When he's in that Virginia parking lot, he's by himself. You know, and I don't know what happens with Kendall when he's on his own.
Usually nothing good. No. Usually nothing good
he
at
usually
all.
Usually goes and checks out some wolf art.
Exactly. I think I can't get over the power of the performances in that scene because there was something I really like the way you framed it. Because you're talking about how they don't need a megaphone to project these characters. They understand them on such like a molecular level. But what was so awesome about the two of them together in that close, tight, very unsuccession-like space was that the dial got turned all the way down, mm-hmm. you know, and they still I think good acting in general is a magic trick, but I have to feel like if you were on set that day, it was a little bit like a seance or something, like these two people just channeling other human beings that they can also be sometimes.
Right.
In everything that they do. I mean, the way the camera knew, because they've worked with McFadden for a while, to like have a camera going on his hands, you know, in the silverware.
Yeah.
And he is good enough at this to not crack. The character is good enough to not crack and show weakness because he's a veteran of business negotiations or whatever. But the actor is so skilled to let us see the, as Kendall put it, hairline fractures running through every fiber of his being. Mm-hmm. What does he say? I've read the prison blogs, Greg. All the details.
Yeah.
That's the other enjoyment level for me on the show is you just have to feel like the writers must have had so much fun Googling this stuff. And just pouring it into this wonderful vessel that is the show they make with all these details that are actually additive. They're not just funny asides. They're additive to our understanding of the psychological state.
They
of
also
the people.
Just do like a little tremendous. Like the point right after Tom orders his food and Kendall's like, yeah, I'm just going to watch him. There's this mm-hmm. brief moment, which is actually very true to the like immediate post ordering moment in a lunch or dinner where you're like, so what do I do with my hands now? Because for like the last 5 minutes, all we've been talking about is like what we're going to eat and what we're going to order. And do you want to split something? And then you put the menu down and you're just kind of like, okay, so like, what are we doing here?
Small aside, this is the least bad thing that has happened because of the global pandemic that has taken untold number of lives and upended our existence. But the QR code menu thing is such an abomination.
Yeah. Are you getting a signal here? Yeah.
It has also broken the social contract.
Right.
Like,
we put our phones away. Yeah.
All of the things that we do in public are absurd, including like wearing clothes or whatever. Like all of this is made up. But you can't just take them away and expect us to function. And one of them is, yes, you sit down at the table and you have sort of awkward, oh, haha, well, good to see you, whatever. But you, yeah, no phones. And then the nice thing that eases you into your time together is there's something to do.
Yes.
There's something to hold in your hands, look away, collect yourself, whatever, look at the menu, immediate conversation starter. But now, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What are we doing? And generally, Chris, I forget. So you're talking and you're doing that small talk, but you're not doing the big talk you want to have yet. Because
let's talk about COVID for 10 minutes.
The food's not here.
Right.
And then the waitress comes and she's like, hey, guys. And you're like, hey, how are you? What are you doing here? Could I have some right.
Yeah.
Right. Got it.
I have found in my dining experiences recently, I'm just desperately trying to slow the process down. Because there's something about the QR code. Because there used to be like this theater where it's like, okay, I can signal publicly that I have now completed my reading of the menu and I'm ready to order.
Yes.
But with the phone, I actually, just like everything else I do on my phone, just get distracted where I'm like halfway through starters and then like I'm like, I think I'll check Twitter. You know, like I'm such a fucking idiot that I can't even get through a menu. And then I'm like, do I say, hey, we're ready? Like, well, you can't signal that you've put the menu down.
You can't put it down because then if you put your phone down, and then the waitress comes over and it's like, you're okay, let me pick my phone up again. Oh, no, I guess I'm wearing a mask. Well, it's not recognizing my face.
Yeah.
I got to put in this is a disaster. We have to do better, people.
Let me get to this final segment here really quick.
Wait, before you do, last thing on this, I think it's worth noting with the Tom and Kendall stuff is that Tom has no options. There's genuine pathos here. This really is awful.
Yeah.
And that walk back into the hotel where he's looking over his shoulder and he sees Greg. I mean, if this were a lesser show, if this was no offense, if this was like a lesser AMC drama from 2014, I'd be like, wow, Tom's going to go kill himself.
Right.
Like this is being shot like that. This isn't right. That show.
This is McBainey.
Which makes it more interesting, but there's something else going on here. His only defense to Kendall in those moments, and Kendall, regardless of his stature, is still the alpha because he is still an untouchable billionaire, basically, and Tom still sees him as such, is that Tom keeps saying, well, I fell in love with your sister. I fell in love with your sister. And every time he says a variation of that, Kendall's like, right, sure. But it is such a brutal indictment of human emotion.
I love when
But it also isn't wrong because of their scenes together. The Shiv and Tom scenes.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Shiv and Tom scene. Now, you know, typically now in modern NBA, it's generally agreed upon that the ball finds energy. You know, that getting everybody involved, making sure everybody gets a shot, everybody gets a touch is the way to go. And I think that applies to podcasts as well.
Oh.
But right now, we're going to go back to the late 90s. And we're clearing out for number three at the top of the key. Everybody's
we're going
spreading.
ISO?
Yeah. Talk to me about some biodynamic German wine.
Well, I want to begin here. Thank you, first of all.
Right.
Thank you. This was the most important scene in the episode.
Season, maybe? Yeah.
Without question.
Yeah.
Certainly in this vintage. Matthew McFadden's hands deserve an award because I don't know how he can make his hands an extension of the performance he's giving, but the way they kind of just worry over the bottles, you know, and the little throwaways like, oh, screw cap, you know. The way that every detail of this wine that he has somehow put money into is just disappointing him. It is just not good enough from the packaging to its where it's from, to the grape, to the style of farming, to ultimately its, I can only assume, hideous aroma.
Yeah.
And even
a
worse.
A funk to it.
Oat Barnyard, as the great New York Magazine critic Adam Platt used to say.
When he says you have to meet it halfway.
Oh my God, I almost
I
died.
Felt that.
I had to shut off. I had to shut off the episode. Like it was kind of amazing. I mean, look, I've put this information out there publicly, but I think that good wine can come from almost any place and can be made
Kaya
in almost
agrees.
Any way.
Kaya McMullen agrees.
But yeah. But the idea that wine should somehow be aggressively challenging to the palate. That somehow this idea that we in the 21st century with our fucked economies and totally broken, ravaged soil have figured out a way to do wine better than people in France 200 years ago, like we've cracked the code, is such bullshit. It's the height of arrogance and bullshit. And I love it. I love that he was just like a week after being, after saying the, you know, look, it's the Greenwald ethos. There's nothing better than a bracingly chilled glass of white wine at 5 p.m. that he's then going to pour himself a big jug of juice.
Yeah.
Of just like
toilet wine. Yeah.
Biodynamic natural garbage. I loved it. What is it? It's quite bad, isn't it?
Yeah.
The fact
that he checks another bottle is the bad one. He's just like, maybe that was a bad bottle. I'll check another one.
He's so disappointed. And it's so, you know, I don't know. There is no rhyme or reason to making of good TV. And we've talked about this in other contexts recently on the podcast that, like, if you ask the people responsible for a success, more often than not, they will be just as flummoxed and surprised as the people who were responsible for a disaster. Because when you're in it, you're not really aware of it. But I can't help but, even though I know that, when Succession is humming, as it was in this episode, I go to this impossible place where I'm like, they must have a writer's room on top of their writer's room, where
right.
every page passes through and it only goes to air, or goes to production, if it checks every imaginable box. Like, is this funny? Yes. Is this insightful? Yes. Is this giving us perspective on the characters? Yes. Is this exactly the right moment to begin the scene and get out of the scene? And does it showcase the massive acting talent that we have appropriately? I mean, yes, 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 yes.
Yeah.
And that's not how it works. And I'm sure that, you know, when we get to talk to Jesse Armstrong again, he will laugh at the suggestion that there's that, that there's time
sure,
for that,
there's
type
that,
of
those kinds of checks and balances.
But of that kind of rigor, but when it's working, man, as it was for me in this episode, like you said, I mean, you structured, because you are a master of structure yourself, this podcast to get to the scene with the wine. And I was in such ecstasies over its trenchant evisceration of the American political landscape that I forgot about the time Tom drank the barnyard wine. Like, I just forgot that was also this episode. That's how rich it was.
Well, it contains multitudes. So does this podcast. We can wrap it up there unless you have any other notes you wanted to share on this episode.
I'm curious how Kaya felt about the wine scene and about you calling her out for her love of the noble grape.
I myself am perfectly happy with a $10 bottle of wine.
So you would not go for the Roy family vineyard of biodynamics?
That depends on the price range.
Oh, Kaya, got to get you a wine of the month club for Christmas.
Consumer is king.
That voice you just heard was Kaya McMullen. She produced our episode, as she does all of the Watch episodes. We will be taking Thursday off. We hope everybody listening has a lovely Thanksgiving with their friends, family, or whoever they choose to spend it with. I hope it's friends or family, not your enemies. Andy, great seeing you.
Great seeing you too, Chris. Have a great holiday with the toilet, your best friend, and a bottle of something better than that.
We'll see you next Sunday night for the next episode of Succession. Everybody take care.